What I will preface this by is that this is by no means the last word on this. In some ways, this is the beginning of, you know, a work in progress, because what I'm going to sketch out tonight is really a bit of a broad picture, but also just some sketchy details of some of the stuff that was happening, putting it in context, and then sort of to understand where it all comes from. This is why, you know, we're hoping to do sort of a lot more work on this, because this is not something that I'm going to be able to just cover in this 35 minutes, and also, you know, I haven't done all of the research that needs to be done to look at these issues. Okay. So we've been hearing about war, resistance and revolution all over this weekend, and in the days of May 1969, you could be forgiven for thinking that Australia may well have been on the brink of its own mass working class revolt. Pat Cansey, a leading communist and head of one of the big construction unions, claimed, "If you think this is a declaration of war, then that's what it's about." And in those heady days of May 1969, when the country stopped over the jailing of Tramways union leader Clary O'Shea, Pat Clancy's words did not sound too far-fetched. Even John Ducker, one of the most right-wing of union leaders, then Secretary of the New South Wales Trades and Labour Council, advocated that the ruthless, tyrannical penal clauses be met not by talk, but by coordinated militant action in every city of the Commonwealth. And this is how Tribune, the Communist Party of Australia's paper, saw it on that first day. That's the front page. Historic strike wave defies penal system. Tribune wrote, "That rank-and-file readiness to struggle for freedom from the capitalist control over the workers. This is the most important fact revealed at this early stage of the struggle. A defiant Laurie Carmichael, leader of the Manufacturing Workers' Union, now the AMWU, another communist, told a shop stewards' meeting in late May, 'We are going to break that law until it is repealed.'" In the wake of the tumultuous days of 1968, when students and workers had thrown France into turmoil, revolt and its bloody suppression in Czechoslovakia, a rising tide of opposition to the Vietnam War, black women's and gay movements hitting the streets in demonstrations and riots, there was a sense of revolution in the air. A whole new layer of society. Students were also drawn into action. But this is not really a talk about this aspect of those heady days. While in the world of student struggles, social movements and anti-war action, the struggle was escalating. In terms of industrial action, a fair chunk of the 1960s, along with the 50s, looks, and I'm going to emphasise looks, more like a plateau between the highs of the immediate post-war era, 1945 to 50, and the 1970s. So Diane's going to hand out a graph that I've only got a limited number of copies of, and I've got it on the board here. What we see, 1945 to 50, it's dropped down to 2 million days here. But this is the period that we're going to be looking at. Looks pretty ordinary when you compare it to, you know, 10.2 million days there, 7 million days there, and, you know, the sort of period in between. And the period 45 to 50 was one of the most militant times in Australia's industrial history. The Master Builders Association complained of the insatiable demands of unionism and that militant unions were like mad dogs that have tasted blood. The Communist Party put a different slant on events, you know, one that we'd sort of found more acceptable. It wrote, "Steelworkers in Newcastle and Port Kembla, railway workers in WA and Queensland, meat workers in Brisbane, government transport workers in Victoria, metal workers in Victoria. These and a great range of other actions were marked by protest resolutions, public meetings, central rallies, leaflet campaigns, deputations to Parliament, street processions, stop work meetings, overtime bans, go slow tactics, ban on New Labour, mass resignations, 24-hour stoppages, refusals to work certain shifts, short unheralded stoppages, stay-in strikes and other strikes of varying duration." Then, if we look at the next peak, in the 70s, the Sydney Morning Herald wrote in 1971, "Australia is approaching a situation intolerably close to industrial anarchy." Let's imagine what they would have written had they known that by 1974, strike days would have reached 7 million. And one of the things that would have really spooked them was that in 1970, when sailors and Air Force pilots effectively mutinied over pay. So that gives you a sense of how far through society it's gone. But what we're going to do is return to this sort of lower period here. And returning to this in-between period, what we saw was a dramatic fall in strike figures in the 1950s, and heralding in 1960, strike figures for 1959, which were the lowest since 1913. 1961, in the middle of a short, sharp recession, which was known as the credit squeeze, saw them heading lower again. And then if we look at the other end of this graph, sort of past 2004, as you're probably aware, the figure's been trending ever downwards, along with unionisation rates. And while this doesn't count the mass protests over work choices and unionisation rates may have stabilised, levels of industrial action continue to fall. The December 2006 quarter, with only 40 strikes in the whole of Australia, was the second lowest on record, and in the past year, industrial action on building sites in Victoria fell from around 23,000 to 7,400. Again, though, those figures don't count the November 2006 protests. So, now I've depressed you all. Not only are we going to be, are we in a period of some of the lowest strike and unionisation figures ever in Australia, but we're going to talk about a period, the 1960s, that at least initially didn't seem to show much promise. If anything, it seemed to be part of a similar trend to today, going downwards. And perhaps what may be equally depressing is that apart from the initial low rate of industrial action, there are really very few direct parallels with today, which of course begs the question, why have a talk about socialists in the 1960 struggles? Well, there are some important parallels and some very important lessons for us today about rebuilding in the union movement and how crucial the role of a socialist organisation is in that process. Now, I'm not going to draw out all those lessons for people, but this is sort of, you know, what part of what we're going to be really talking about. What is similar to today is the level of worker discontent over harsh legislation and the question of how to beat back the ruling class offensive. As much as in the 1950s and 60s, where workers wanted an end to Menzies' union bashing legislation, and Menzies was the Prime Minister at the day, there's no doubt that workers today want to see an end to Howard's anti-union laws. The mass protests since 2004 are compelling evidence of that, not to mention the near riot at Parliament House in 1996 and the maritime dispute in 1998. The latest opinion polls are a clear indication of continued dissatisfaction, and at the beginning of this week, you know, still seeing over 60% opposed to Howard's laws. And today, many have wanted to go further than a one-day or half-day stoppage every 6 months. So when the French students and workers fought similar wars, Australian workers looked to their example of what unions needed to do here. And then the talk started to happen about the days of Clary O'Shea, when millions stopped work and stopped the country. Few, however, really know sort of how this happened. And the talk is part of addressing that question. And as you'll see, it's as much a talk about the 1950s as it is about the 1960s. We can't just draw, you know, convenient lines this decade, that decade. They're actually sort of, you know, different periods that we need to look at. It's about harsh anti-union laws. It's about jailing and fining of unions, the slow process of building a rank and file schooled in struggle, about militants held back by right-wing union leaderships, and this should sound familiar to most people, about defeat after defeat, about the role of the Communist Party, which is different. It's about the dark days of Menzies' era. It's about the rising tide of protests against the war and even the ultimate nuclear war, uranium, black, gay and women's rights. And it's about how to defeat the anti-union laws. So just do a little bit of history. Today, in all of the hullabaloo about the draconian work choices legislation, how it and the Orwellian-named Building Industry Improvement Act threaten workers and their unions with fines and jailing, taking away almost every avenue for industrial action and civil rights, it's easy to overlook the fact that capital always uses its state powers to regulate, control and penalise the working class. From the first known law in England against workers in 1349, a law which enforced a working day of 14 hours, kept wages down and made it a crime to quit your job, through the anti-combination laws of 1799, the sort that resulted in workers being jailed, transported or executed for organising into combinations or unions in the 1800s, to today. Capital has been ruthless in its penalties against workers for the crime of standing up for their rights and organising against the ruling class. And it is as well capital has been ruthless in its use of state forces to enforce these laws. And the results have often been devastating for the working class and its organisations. Just taking one example, if we think things are bad now, in the early days of Australian unionism, after the mass strikes of 1890 were defeated, of the 100 unions affiliated to the New South Wales Trades and Labour Council, 7 survived the strikes. And unionisation was down to around 5%. I might be wrong about that figure, but it's very, very low. In the wake of the defeat, a new law to regulate industrial relations was drawn up. You wouldn't think they'd want one, but they were very keen to get in before workers started organising again. And this was the Conciliation and Arbitration Act of 1904. It introduced a system of registration of unions and employers, brought them together in a court to so-called resolve the disputes and hand down enforceable awards covering their wages and conditions. So, for example, it actually became a criminal offence to pay less than the minimum wage. However, the gains were essentially to the ruling class. It delivered to employers through the Commission a cradle-to-the-grave supervision of trade unions, their rules, their membership requirements, the elections, the amalgamations, financial accounting, and even their very existence. When the Waterside Workers Federation, now in the Maritime Union, wanted a national award for their members, the court said, OK, but you have to amend your rules to give the right-wing Federal Council the power to discipline what were its more militant branches. And a couple of unions were actually deregistered. And, of course, it provided real penalties. Jails, fines for members, for union officials and the union itself. So you could have a triple-level fine all the way through. Or, as I said, even deregistration. Cutting the union adrift and effectively taking away their coverage in an industry. Employers could also be charged, but in the history of arbitration, fines for employers were in the order of $3,000, while those against unions went into the millions. And it wasn't just the fines, the unions also got the costs of the employer's legal action, so that you could find a case where you had a $100,000 fine and you had a $100,000 costs. And, I won't go into all of that, but that's sort of, they just kept hitting people over the head. But within arbitration, one of the most effective tools for the ruling class in this period was the bans clause. This clause made it an offence to fail to work in accordance with the award, and also specifically prohibited any ban, limitation or restriction upon the performance of work in accordance with the award. The bans clause could go in before, after or during industrial action for any specified or even unlimited amount of time. On the waterfront, they had a bans clause put in 1960. It was still there in 1963, and they used it to sort of hammer the union then. It was for use against the whole union, although it may have only been one small job site where workers were in dispute with their boss. And it was these penalties that were known as the penal powers, and that's why I'm saying, this strike against the penal system. The federal government also had equivalent laws directed at specific industries. They went for coal and the waterfront, much as they've done today, and they also used the Crimes Act, though to a much lesser extent. The state governments introduced a similar sort of procedure, and in New South Wales, BHP used these laws with devastating effect against the unions in the steel industry. Now, the first bans clause was inserted in the pastoral ward in 1907, but initially the penal clauses themselves were actually only sparely used. After all, there was the turmoil of the two world wars and the 1930s depression sandwiched in between. However, after World War II, if the ruling class was to get the benefit of war and not to plunge into a 1930s-type depression, again, as many had feared, massive restructuring of industry, even whole economies, was necessary. And that, the ruling class determined, would be at workers' expense and without resistance. However, initially in Australia, the working class did go on the offensive. Some even called it a revenge for the privations of the Depression and war. And as I said, the period 45 to 50 saw 10.2 million strike days, 1950, 2 million out. Workers also won huge improvements in wages and conditions. And as late as 1960, unions were calling for an increase in the margins component of wages, which was a payment over the basic wage to cover skills, to restore to the 1947 equivalent, having gone backwards over the 50s. But this tide of working class combativity declined with the economic uncertainty of the 50s and an aggressive attack by the ruling class, including the Labour Party's smashing of the 1949 miners' strike when the troops were brought in to mine coal. Chifley and his party were dumped in the December 1949 election and replaced by a Liberal National Party coalition, well, just called Liberal National Party, I think it was a different name then, under John Howard's political idol, Robert Menzies. With the working class more defensive, strike figures dropped from 2 million to, in 1950 to under 1 million in 51 and basically kept going down. I mean, well, we'll see a bit later. There's some variations on that. But at the same time, Menzies began an ideological sort of anti-communist push, what we know as the Cold War, and an industrial war on the working class. In some ways, you know, you can see how John Howard has learnt from his idol. In the 1950s, however, the Communist Party was still, in the early 1950s, the Communist Party was still optimistic about potential working class upheavals. In fact, it was precisely because of the economic uncertainties, even another crisis and the prospect of war, as Menzies declared he was putting the country on a war footing, coupled with the experience of the 45-50 period, that gave the party cause for such a positive outlook. I mean, in 1947, they still had 12,000 members, and in 1952, claimed that 1% of the union membership in the manufacturing industry, in the manufacturing union, were in the Communist Party. But the possibility of another upsurge was dented by Menzies' attack on the Communist Party itself, increased use of anti-union measures against the working class and a recovering economy that delivered improved living standards despite some serious plunges causing peaks of unemployment. Nonetheless, a snapshot of the first half of the 1950s would still show a combative working class with strike figures still around a million a year, and even the beginning, even beginning to rise slightly through, though the number of disputes dropped steadily. A Labour movement that had defeated Menzies on the anti-communist bill and the referendum that came after, and some active resistance to the use of anti-union rules. This was also the end of the first sort of period in a way of this sort of modern use of the penal powers. There had been battles, especially in 1951 and 52, when 10 union leaders were jailed, many of them Communist Party members. Jailing had led to build-ups of nationwide stoppages and solidarity action and the like across the country, and it was starting to affect all sectors of the economy. In other words, started to see a bit of a generalisation of the action and perhaps the beginning of a resurgence of working class activity. At the same time they were jailing people, from 51 to 55, there were only 16 fines imposed and a total of about $10,600. But this changed in 1956. The combination of rising unemployment, growing national solidarity actions, sort of generalisation of the fight against the penal powers, and a major revamp of the Arbitration Act to counteract a successful challenge by the Boilermakers Union saw a change in the tactics of the ruling class as it turned away from jailing union leaders to more widespread use of fines. And the initial response from the organised working class was a sharp drop in the strike figures. But it also marked the beginning of what was ultimately to be the defeat of the penal powers. What Menzies did in this thing that made things so different is he divided the arbitration court into two, an arbitration commission or arbitration conciliation commission, which would still hear and settle disputes, putting the bans clauses in and the like, continue to control union registration, and the second part, an industrial court, which would impose the fines and sanctions. And it was in the parliamentary debate around these amendments that the ALP dubbed the Court of Pains and Penalties. And so it was. From this point on, the court systematically penalised unions with fines rather than jailing as the major deterrent. 2 years later, in 1958, with increasing automation and other changes in the national economy, employment skyrocketed till it peaked in December 1961, and the coal industry was particularly hard hit. The Minister for Labour, Harold Holt, who fortunately drowned later, again increased the powers of the Arbitration Commission. Somewhat unrealistically at this point, the Communist Party was still confident that Menzies' attack could be rebuffed. Despite rising unemployment and falling strike figures, one of the 1958 headlines in Tribune claimed, "A great working class offensive against the hated Menzies government is underway. Determination to hold on to and extend hard-won gains is underscored by reports from New South Wales and Queensland of important trade union decisions. With the pressure really on, 1958 can be the year of shorter hours and higher wages." Well, let's look at graph number two, which is this smaller one here, and we'll see 58-59 strike figures, disputes hitting, you know, close to their lowest levels. And it's a more, you know, volatile picture than that bigger graph shows. The bottom ones, they're the fines and penalties. These two are the number of disputes and the days lost. Just before, see, 1966, still going down, low figure in 67, though the number of disputes seem to be holding the line. But in 1966, the Sydney Morning Herald industrial correspondent Fred Wells wrote, "The 2 million strong trade union movement, while on paper the largest and most powerful pressure group in the land, actually is woefully weak." So, in fact, however, what these figures show is that something began changing from 1960. The economy begins to pick up, and apart from this drop here in 61, which really, when you look at the rest of the 60s, is somewhat of an anomaly, the figures start to rise. Unemployment's easing, and as the Communist Party noted, another layer of people started coming into the workforce. Women and younger workers, especially in manufacturing, and there was more action from some of the white-collar and professional unions. You hear reports of national sort of bank workers' stoppages, 6,000 workers around Australia going out. You hear about the national salaried and professional officers, peak union body, calling rallies in Sydney alongside blue-collar workers' unions. Start to sort of see some of that going on. Laurie Carmichael, who I think I referred to earlier as, from the Manufacturing Workers' Union, adds that from 1957, particularly in Victoria, there was an emergence of a strata of young activist unions. It arose from the split in the ALP, the Labor Party, in 1954, a major split in Victoria, which led to the formation of the so-called Democratic Labor Party, which was sort of the right wing. And in that process, they also, you know, effectively were driven out of the union movement here in Victoria. And in that process, a whole range of the activists and the leaderships of those unions and sort of who'd been active around the labour movement were discredited, had gone into the DLP or had just dropped out altogether. And he says that this, by 1957, the impact of that split had started to push up a whole layer of young activist unionists. And he adds, this also helps explain, as far as he understands the situation, explains why the fight against the penal powers erupted in Victoria. And as well, communists had won back leadership within sections of the union movement. Jack McPhillips claimed that by 1960 there were a large number of, and he's another Communist Party person, claimed that by 1960 there were a large number of Communist Party members occupying full-time and honorary positions in the leadership of various trade unions and in workshop organisations and also on leading councils and the ACTU executive, although that changed a bit. So although the figures don't show it initially, the basis for a fight against the penal powers was developing at the rank and file level within the unions, led very often by the Communist Party and to a certain extent the left of the ALP. And I'll just give you one example within one union of how some of this sort of also started to build up. And this is within the Builders Labourers Federation from 1951 to 64. I'm not going to look at everything there, but just at the very beginning, in 1950 you start off with a union that is strongly anti-communist. They want to sack the union officials. They want the members to sign up to say whether they're a communist or not. And if they do say they are, well, then they're not going to get membership, obviously. But Despite that, the Communist Party decided to make a push into all of the unions in construction. They already had control of one of the big unions, the Building Workers Industrial Union, which covered carpenters and plasterers and the like, and so they started to organise in the other unions. Joe Ferguson recalls the party went through their membership and found out people who were members of the other construction unions, and they set up party committees. And then they started to organise on the job. He says rank and file groups, sort of very up and down affairs, but also within the building, certainly within the BLF, they had to face the casual nature of the employment, the fact that the union leadership sent out people to bash people up, bash them up at the branch meetings, all that kind of stuff. It actually demoralised a whole lot of people and drove them away from the union. And he said, but they kept on going. They spoke about issues on the jobs, about wet weather, about no amenities and things like that. Gradually, we started to build up a bit of a following. It took 18 months before they held their first public meeting. 15 people turned up, 5 Communist Party members and 10 other rank-and-file BLs. And he said, we started to build up organisation where we had delegates, blokes giving out their newsletter, the Hoist, set up a network of delegates. Then they'd go round, talk to workers at home on the weekends, and as well, they had some friendly delegates in the BWIU. And we built the organisation that way, and he said it was just a lot of patient work. Jim Baird from the manufacturing workers also points out strong development of shop stewards committees during this period as well. He said another factor that was important when you look at what happened in the penal clause struggle was that between 1950 and 1965 there had been a massive development in the shop stewards movement. There was the Waterside Workers Delegates Committee, there were the power station committees, there was the metal industry shop committee movement. I think it would be true to say that at no period in the history were the workers in Australia so well prepared, so well organised for a struggle. I'm not sure about how true that is, but that's at least his claim. When you look at it, there was sort of devolution within the union movement because, particularly in the metals industry, most metal shops were very small, under 50 people. The union itself had 200 organisers nationwide. There was no way they could get round to all of the jobs, so there was a lot of sort of independent organisation going on. And that was sort of helped fuel the shop stewards movement as well. And the committees were a source of political education. They mostly dealt with internal issues such as wages and conditions, sackings and the like, issues generated out of their work. But they also got other more political requests from outside the committees as people got to know about what they were doing, you know, and sort of also through the Communist Party. For example, there'd be letters asking for support for political causes, requests for speakers at rallies and so on. And they'd give rise to a debate within the shop committees, and as one of the activists commented, raised the political level amongst the stewards. The Communist Party ran weekly trade union lectures, got local branches to adopt a factory, and they were very organised within the party to keep the union members active as socialists within their workplaces. And they talked about how, you know, at one point they got 12 members joined up and they had particular sort of things, what you had to do when a dispute happened, how you had to sort of, you know, analyse what happened, which members in the workplace were likely to be members of the Communist Party and all of that kind of thing. And it's not to say, though, that the Communist Party always did the right thing. As Tom outlines in Into the Mainstream, at Newport here between 1958 and 61, as they started to develop a very strong shop stewards movement there, the Communist Party official leadership tried to stop this 24-hour strike. The strike was on as the officials came walking across the bridge and Vic Williams just said to them, don't bother, the strike's going on. And, you know, they had to accept that that was happening. And now the Communist Party would have stopped that strike, would have stopped the development of what became the sort of power station committee and led to the Latrobe 1977 dispute. So, I mean, it was not always that the Communist Party did the right thing. On the industrial front, we look at some of the key moments as the industrial battle shifted up. It's important to remember that throughout this, the Communist Party and its allies were looking to generalise the disputes. Exactly when this started to happen, I don't know, though Laurie Carmichael claims the left strategy had been determined by 1959. It's not, I mean, you know, the height of that, or the sort of the depths of the struggle. I don't know whether that's true or not, but, I mean, certainly there are differing dates around about when it started up. In 1962, one of the most important things that happened was at a 4,000-strong New South Wales job delegates meeting in manufacturing, and it called by the New South Wales Trades and Labor Council in response to wide demands for action. And it called for a federal unions conference. Hal Alexander from the CPA said this was one of the most significant post-war demonstrations of working class activity. You had a fight, but what started to happen, you started to have more rallies outside the Arbitration Commission as workers started demonstrating when the Arbitration Commission was about to bring down a decision about wages. This is all 63. You started to have where the waterfront unions forced Menzies to suspend a new penal clause and to drop £750,000 worth of fines. In 64, you had the huge DMH strike. The ACTU buckled under because the employers threatened to fine everybody. The fines still came, even when the workers were back. There was no backlash, but the bitterness, because the fines were so huge, fueled later on. The peak bodies like the ACTU were starting to feel the pressure. That call for a national unions conference actually happened in 64, and the unions discussed, they didn't succeed, but they discussed a national stoppage. In 67, and just a week later, the threat of a nationwide strike action by 60,000 transport workers resulted in a promise that the bans clause would be removed, showing that industrial action could actually beat back the penal powers. 67, and we're nearly finished. Although it's a refusal of the tramways union to pay fines resulting from a long-running dispute, the pivotal case leading up to 1969 was the margins case of 67-68 in the manufacturing industry. At first, you got sort of a big drop in disputes. Starting to go down there. In the wake of the big fines of GMH. But the margins case, they tried to force through what was effectively a pay cut, although it was supposed to be a pay rise. Everybody went out. Unlike what had happened before, they just said no. And somebody said in a 5-month period, there was an absolute outbreak of industrial action. Orders flew around about like confetti at a wedding. In the 5-month period, more fines and costs than the total 10 preceding years. The AMWU fined 98,000 and costs of 97,000. On top of that, employers started to sort of go on the offensive. The ACTU sort of took over. In the end, determined was the opposition that the Commission abandoned this proposal and actually said their own proposal was impractical. So along with this increasing rank and file discontent, what was equally crucial, in some ways an accident of history, was the split from the Victorian Trades Hall Council, where 27 rebel unions left or were suspended from Trades Hall Council in 1967. It was a political split, but it was actually increased dues and the question of representation that were the immediate issues. From 1967 as well, the union leadership started to say, we're not paying the fines we've got, and we're not going to pay any future fines. In the 2 years from 67 to 69, workers in the building, into every single job meeting, the officials will be out there saying, we're building up for this campaign. The next time if they jail somebody for not paying the fines, we're going out. And on the day that it happened, Norm Wallace tells me from the Builders Labourers Federation here, he was absolutely inundated with calls. Is this the day we go out? And a whole lot of other people saying, we're out already, don't tell. And so we come to the climax in a way here. For refusing to hand over the union books in May 1969, Clary O'Shea was jailed for contempt of court. The right-wing secretary of Trades Hall Council said to the workers they opposed, there was a call by the rebel unions to go out. People responded to that. The Trades Hall secretary said, don't go out. They issued leaflets telling people, don't do anything, that the penal powers response was just a communist plot. The night of O'Shea's jailing, Trades Hall Council Assistant Secretary Ken Stone, and you'll see Ken Stone rules down there still in the car park, called for the removal of penal powers, but And he said to people, don't go out. And we advise unions and unions that they are in no way obligated to participate in these unauthorised stoppages, as such action is contrary to the rules, the procedures and the decisions of the ACTU. Well, the same day, the ACTU called for the release of O'Shea, the remission of all fines, so, and did back the struggle. The next year, Jim Kavanagh, a Member of Parliament, remarked in Federal Parliament, "It is realised that the solidarity of the trade union movement and its power means that no matter what we do in this Parliament, those penal powers will not be enforced in future."